This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Einen handschützenden Damen, einen guten Abend, den Herren und der Jugend. Wir melden uns aus dem Wembley Stadion zu London.
We're not only going to plant the tree, we also want to bury this box. Because as Val says, in the year 2000, we do hope that Blue Peter will still be continuing. So we thought we'd like to leave souvenirs of what we were like and of what the programme was like here in 1971.
Mit dem Finale des Europacups der Meister praktisch abgeschlossen wird. Es stehen einander Ajax Amsterdam und Panathinaikos Athen gegenüber.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the greatest games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Opposite me is Jonathan Wilson. And today joining us is a man you all know. It's Andy Brassel, a man of this Football Ramble Daily parish and European football journalist. Andy, good to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me, fellas.
Yes. And how are you, Jonathan?
I'm very well, thanks.
Marvellous stuff. Well, today we've got a game involving one of the great sides of all time. It's the 1971 European Cup final when Ajax beat Panathinaikos 2-0. Andy, why have you chosen this game?
I think it's a sort of watershed game for a number of reasons, really, because I think it's the moment where Johan Cruyff went from being a great player into someone who was an absolute megastar. This was the moment where he really started to explode. And on the other side, of course, Panathinaikos, you know, you think of it being the start of the Ajax dynasty and stuff. And yes, that is the main story. But Panathinaikos is still the only Greek team to have reached a European final. And, you know, there's a certain context to it. There's the fact that their manager at the time was Ferenc Puskás as well, returning to the scene of one of his most visible triumphs,
the
which made him a superstar. Yeah, exactly. 18 years before. When Hungary played England at Wembley in 53. So I think there's a lot of really interesting angles to this. The other reason, of course, is Jonathan said he hadn't done enough games in the 70s.
I mean, yeah, Jonathan, it's Ajax, we all know about them. But as Andy said, Panathinaikos, one can understandably forget their role in this final because it was extremely unlikely that they would reach the final. But that Ajax side, you know, they you could say, changed the way football is played and understood.
Yeah, they did. And I guess when you have a game like this, you always wonder what would have happened if Ajax hadn't won it.
Mm. Yes.
You know, it feels almost inevitable that Ajax's greatness was manifest. Everybody knew they were great. And obviously it goes on into the Netherlands in 74. And then, you know, all those ideas are transferred to Barcelona. And it sort of shapes modern football, essentially. Mm. But this game, although Ajax certainly had the bulk of the chances, they weren't that dominant. It wouldn't have been a completely crazy result if Panathinaikos had equalised late on, say, and taken it to a replay. And then you wonder, well, they'd already lost in one European Cup final. They'd lost to Milan in 69. What might have happened if they'd lost a second one? And then especially if that had been compounded by the Netherlands losing the 74 final, would total football have been seen as football for nearly men? Would they have won it in 72 and 73? Well, let's not forget that although they were totally dominant in both finals, much more dominant than they were in this game, they only won those two games 1-0.
Absolutely. This shapes the way we think about Ajax, doesn't it? It totally shapes the way we think about Ajax because, of course, Rinus Michels goes straight off to Barcelona after they've won this. I mean, it had been a long season for them. They had to go to a replay to beat Sparta Rotterdam in the KNVB Beker final as they were on their way to winning that as well. So it had been a tough old final and they creaked at certain points. I mean, it's funny, isn't it, how Michels is seen as the genius. Stefan Kovac, who's his successor as coach, is just seen as, you know, just a caretaker.
Yeah, this
really
bumbling nice guy who came in and relaxed them all a bit. He wasn't as intense as Michels. But nobody gives him any credit.
I mean, he won back-to-back European Cup finals, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and they arguably reach bigger heights in those finals. They definitely reach bigger heights in those finals.
Was he the Bob Paisley of the piece?
Possibly. I think you can make that argument.
Well, I think there's actually... I mean, I'm not sure that... maybe it does actually be Shankly Paisley parallel. But I think there's definitely...
Ferguson Moyes?
there's definitely a trend or a pattern you can see in various other places, obviously not a universal pattern, where you have a real hard man comes in and starts something off, as I mean, I guess Buckingham, you could say, began, but Michels takes it to another level. But then for that team to reach its absolute peak, you need somebody to come in and just sort of take away some of the constraints, not be as tough, let the players express themselves more, and you get a slightly more decadent form, but it leads to a more beautiful form of the sport. The players are not constrained by a very strict tactical framework, and that is also actually the seed of their destruction and decline. So I think where you see it really clearly is actually in English cricket, that you had Nasser Hussain who took an England side that was completely kind of shambolic, made them a team more hard to beat, and then Michael Vaughan comes in and makes them a great side that wins the Ashes in 2005.
You know, I really wondered what was going to be the first metaphor. I wondered if it was going to be Jonathan on cricket or Sunderland or me on NBA.
Yeah. Well, you that is your
this
answer.
This is nothing like Jordan's Bulls. I'd like to make that clear. But I think it's like
gardening, isn't it? No, but the in a sense, the job of a gardener is to stop the fruit or the flower reaching full maturity, because as soon as it does, it goes into decline. Mm. So Michels is the great pruner, and Kovac is the man who sort of lets his garden luxuriate, but in doing that, permits it to begin to go into decay.
But it is funny what you were saying about that level of obsession, and sometimes you need the change. I mean, obviously, Michels had other things to do, but I think there was a sense of like the pressure valve being released. I mean, there's that story, isn't there, about Pete Kaiser, who up until this point, and when we talk about this being a transitional moment for Ajax, a lot of people believed that this was Kaiser's team before that he did all the work and Cruyff scored all the goals. A lot of people genuinely believe that, and I think this game and the way it went and the influence that Cruyff had at Wembley started to change that. But how intense Michels was. I mean, it's funny, you know, you think more recently about Bayern players saying when Ancelotti took over from Guardiola, which turned out to be very ill-fated, obviously. The fact is that originally those Bayern players were like, oh, isn't that nice? You know, not to have to be taken through videos of how Mainz are going to play at the weekend. Who cares how Mainz are going to play at the weekend? But there was that story that Pete Kaiser, when he heard the news that Michels had left, he was in his local pub and he got on the table and did a dance because he was so pleased that he'd gone. But yeah, I think it's interesting as well to hear Jonathan bringing up Vic Buckingham, and obviously before that, Jack Reynolds. You have this great English lineage that directly affected Michels, directly affected Johan Cruyff. Like Buckingham's second spell at Ajax wasn't particularly good, but he did give Cruyff his debut in 1964. So that was something that
was not only that, but Cruyff's mother was Buckingham's cleaner. Mm. Cruyff learned English by hanging around with Buckingham's kids. So
it's all very Robson and Villas Boas, isn't it?
Yeah. So once again, to the world of football, you are welcome. it's fascinating. Before we go on and talk about the kind of the legacy and all that, let's talk about the game itself. Mm. Because it was at Wembley, as you say, Ajax in the final against Panathinaikos. Panathinaikos had quite a tough route there. They'd beat Everton. And Red Star.
And they needed a last minute goal at Leophoros.
Yeah, they did
against Everton to do that. Mm-hmm. From Antoniadis, who's the top scorer in the competition.
Fair to say they had an interesting semi final, two legs against Red Star Belgrade. I will use the English pronunciation, or not pronunciation, the English form. Yeah. They lost the first leg 4-1, and then quite incredibly they won the second leg 3-0.
Yeah, Marcus, I think when we do look at the semi-final, you have to bear in mind that Leophoros is a formidable stadium. I don't mean formidable in the sense that it's an arena fit for kings. It's more the fact that it's very tight, very intimidating. I doubt very much has changed much since the 1970s. You get the sense that they've just plonked seats on the existing structure, and you know it's not for the faint-hearted. So you have to bear that in mind. And of course, Antoniadis did have a big influence as well as the top scorer in the competition in the comeback. But we have to look at the context of where Panathinaikos were and where Greek culture was as well, because between 1967 and 1974 it was a military dictatorship under Georgios Papadopoulos, and he gave a lot of political favour and material financial favour to Panathinaikos to help them get to where they were. And you know, we've seen how dictatorships use sport, because he wasn't a particularly big football fan, as a symbol of power. We've seen that in various other occasions, and obviously Jonathan's written about that in his work about Argentinian football, for example. And it was interesting. I mean, you know, we're almost desensitized in the modern era to great comebacks in the Champions League and the European Cup, but this was something quite extraordinary against Red Star in the semi. And
also, we should still hammer home the point that Panathinaikos, it's not like, oh, they were a really good side, and often in the past European Cups you would get these, like a great storybook, or S side won it in the late 80s, or I don't know, one or two other teams. They were very unlikely. Greek football was not particularly all singing, all dancing. It was very, very unlikely that Panathinaikos would get to the final.
Yeah, and
so it's still a big thing back then.
In fact, in 2007, Despina Gaspari, who's the widow of Papadopoulos, she claimed that the second leg was fixed.
Right.
She said she was really worried about the about them being down after the first leg, and her husband told her, "Don't worry about it. It's all in hand." And they did get to Wembley, of course. And
sorry, did she give any details of the fix? I mean, in it was fixed, as in the referee
Red Star were paid. She said,
you know, the interesting thing about that is that in 1966, when Partizan got to the final and lost to Real Madrid, there were all kinds of rumours that game had been sold. And I know Vazovic, who played for Ajax in this game, was playing for Partizan in that game.
Yeah.
And I know he always was furious about the suggestions and said, no, they were just better than us. Come on, look at them. They were a great side. And then, of course, when Zvezda got to the final in 91, there were all kinds of very strange rumours about...
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there are going to be rumours when you're playing Tapis Marseille. but it does seem to be a constant theme with Yugoslav sides that, I don't know, whether there's a paranoia maybe in the Yugoslav media, kind of thought that their players were particularly susceptible, or whether it's just an economic fact that the people from Yugoslavia, because their income was relatively low,
yes,
they were bribeable, because you didn't have to have huge sums to make it very worth their while.
Exactly. And it's interesting, I think, that while Despina Gaspari spoke about it on Greek television, the only place where it was internationally reported was in fact Serbia.
Right. Okay.
Afterwards, which I found quite interesting. Although obviously there's the Red Star angle to it. But I think Marseille are a really good point as well, Jonathan, because I think it is worth underlining that whatever the implications, the allegations, and the proven facts, like with Marseille in '93, this is still a terrific side. A terrific Panathinaikos side. And Ferenc Puskás, who, as we said, has this incredible history with Wembley. And when you watch back the old footage of it, of the 1971 final, and Kenneth Wolstenholme talks about it all the time. He talks about it all the time during commentary, and I love that. And he gets to the end, and he's like, "Yes, Ferenc Puskás looks like he's going to end up a loser today." He sounds ever so jolly about it. But this was Puskás' only real moment as a coach. Obviously, one of the greatest players in the history of a game. As a coach, he never really had that sort of impact. Now, he was at Panathinaikos for 5 years, as we said, in a very particular time in Greek history, modern Greek history and modern Greek football history, and in Panathinaikos history. And this was the first time he'd won a league championship, and he did that this season. And this side went on to, you know, as Jonathan said, put in a really creditable display in the final. And Antoniadis, he was something that they found very difficult to deal with. Mm. You look at Ajax there, and, you know, when we look at the modern Ajax team who were so brilliant in the Champions League last season, you think, oh, with a little tweak and a couple of tweaks at the back, you know, with maybe a little bit less cavalier, maybe they would have been able to go on and win it. And what you say, Jonathan, before about sliding doors, well, there are moments in this. Vasovic is on his last legs as a player and retires straight after the final, and he couldn't deal with Antoniadis at all.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
Well, Vasovic, yeah, might as well sort of
sure.
mention him and why he ended up at Ajax. It's, essentially, Michels thought that Ajax weren't tough enough. He thought they were too pretty. Let's bring in a hard man Serbian defender.
Let's get a Serbian centre.
And like, you know, Vasovic was all of that and a supremely good footballer as well. He was a hard man who could play football. And I think, you know, we talked earlier about the transition from Michels to Kovac. And I think the personalities of the coach had a lot to do with the subtle changes in how Ajax played between 71 on the one hand and 72-3. But Vasovic being replaced by Blankenberg on the side, it was also key that they lost the hard man and they got in a better passer of the ball, essentially.
Mm-hmm. But Vasovic was also the captain of the side, if I'm
Yeah, he was a proper leader. Yeah,
was he the only non-Dutchman in the starting
11? He was the only foreigner in either starting 11. I mean, Blankenberg came on, he's a German.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the Panathinaikos 11 Greeks, Ajax, 10 Dutchmen plus him, plus Blankenberg.
All right, gentlemen, after the break, we will talk about the match itself. See you in a moment. Reinders
to Hülltop, der Kaiser. Und Tor! 1-0. Und zwar war es Van Dijk. Van Dijk. Hier die Wiederholung.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Und Tor! Tor 2-2 nach Vorarbeit des Verhahn.
Let's talk about the game itself, the 90 minutes that happened. Ajax score quite early on, Jonathan.
Yeah.
After about 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's a move that I think is very characteristic of that Ajax team, and one that perhaps we don't associate with them at all, which is Barry Hulshof whacking the long ball over the top. But they like that as a way of getting behind teams. He plays this long diagonal from the centre circle in behind Tomáš, the Panathinaikos right back, and then Kaiser, who really had been, as Andy said, the icon of the side before Cruyff sort of comes through. Classic bit of wing play, cuts inside, nice little cross. And Dick Van Dyke glances the ball into the corner.
The wonderfully named, nicknamed Dick Van Dyke, we should say.
Diagnosis goal.
Very good. So it was a great start for Ajax, Andy.
It was.
And they never looked back.
I think the past is definitely in their minds at that moment. I don't want to second guess it too much, but you got the impression that, again, I think context is everything. In 69, when Vasovic scores in the final, he scored in two previous finals, of course. He scored in the final for Partizan, and then he scored in the 69 final when they got absolutely belted by that Milan side. You get the impression, whether it's Mikkels putting the wind up them before they go out, or then saying to themselves, we cannot let this opportunity slip, they go out there and they really grab the game by the horns. This is where they say, right, this is our moment. We're winning this time.
Yeah.
But we're not mucking about. And I think the interesting thing about this game is when you watch it now with fresh eyes, is how quick it is.
Yeah, you know, that's true.
It's really, really fast-paced game. I mean, Panathinaikos are able to respond to that fast start in the end. But I think as well as losing in 69 and feeling that they should have done better, that they should have given a better account of themselves, maybe experience-wise, they weren't ready against that Milan side. The thing that happens in 1970 is Feyenoord, of all teams, become the first Dutch team to win the European Cup. And that really pisses them off.
But it's an interesting point how you say that they thought, right, we've got to win this. And it feeds into the point about Mikkels that there was that sort of intensity and maybe uptightness about the whole operation. When they win against Panathinaikos in later finals under Kovac. One of the games they won 1-0.
Both of them they won 1-0.
Right, okay. And were very relaxed 1-0s.
Well, certainly the Juve game in 73, and I think this actually is what ends up costing them in 74, the national team.
Yes, exactly.
So 73, they take the lead very early through Johnny Rep. I think the third or fourth minute they score. And then they basically just hold the ball. And they're doing it with a sense of they're really taking the piss out of you.
Yeah.
And it's almost like they're saying, you think 1-0 is your result. Your 1-0s with the Catenaccio, you can have them. Mm. This is one of our 1-0s, and we're going to have fun making it 1-0. And we're going to humiliate you. And then, of course, in the 74 World Cup final, when many of the same players are there, they take the lead in the first minute with a penalty. And I think there's a similar thing of, let's take the piss out of the Germans.
Huge rivalry.
And the problem is you could you could take liberties maybe with that Juve side. You could not take liberties with Gerd
Müller and West Germany. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I think the other thing you think about in relation to the 1974 World Cup final, when you watch this, about the difference that Horst Blankenberg makes when he comes on, and the fact that he could never get a game for Germany. Well, he never played a single game for Germany, Blankenberg, because Beckenbauer was around at the same time, and they're both that sort of libero type player. And Cruyff, of course, Blankenberg spent what, 5 years in the Netherlands. Cruyff spent a lot of that time, especially the second half, with Speller Ajax chipping away at him and going, come play for us. Mm. Come play for us at the 74 World Cup. Declare for Holland. And he was never having it. Now, what a story that would have been if Blankenberg ended up in the Dutch team for the 74 World Cup.
Winning the final in Munich. I think it's worth mentioning as well, we mentioned Van Dijk, a proper centre forward, which again is something you don't think of with Ajax. You think of them in their later iteration with Cruyff as the false nine. And it, I have to say, it took me quite a while to work out what their formation was, which I guess was part of the problem that opponents had.
Make a feel for them, yeah.
But the Cruyff starts off sort of playing on. It is a 4-3-3, although with Vazovic as a sweeper rather than being a flat four. Johan Neeskens is playing at right back, which is when you think of what an attacking midfielder he appeared in 1974, was a bit of a shock. But he gets forward a lot.
Yeah,
Serbia, who's you think of as a right back, was playing on the left because obviously Ruud Krol isn't there. And then a player I'd sort of totally forgotten about, Nico Reinders, playing the back of midfield, who, a tragic story. It's, he collapsed later that year on the pitch. His life was saved, but he died 2 years later. And he's one of, somebody who, if you say, name a great Dutch footballer of the early 70s, you can name sort of 15, 16, 17. It takes a long time before you get around to Nico Reinders. But he was vital in this game because Cruyff was playing as a midfielder. You had to have that defensive presence in the midfield. Jerry Meeren alongside him, I guess. I mean, to call him a shuttler is to do him a gross disservice, but that is a job he's doing, sort of filling in, getting up and down. So Cruyff playing this sort of very attacking central midfield role, getting up to support Van Dijk. But Van Dijk is, I'm not going to say he's a target man, but he's a good head of the ball. It's a great head of the goal. It's a really beautifully placed header in the far post. But he has the physique of a normal centre forward, a 6 foot player who can play with his back to goal. And then, the two classic wingers with Kaiser on one side and Svart on the other, though Svart went off at half time. Mm.
The other thing with Van Dijk, I suppose, is, and the other thing you notice when you rewatch the game, the link with him and Cruyff. And when you think of Kaiser as the creative force in the Ajax team up until this point, as the game progresses, it's all about Cruyff. But the way that he links with Van Dijk, I mean, as you say, your average target man, even your very good target man, can't have that sort of intuition with a player of the level of Johan Cruyff. And Cruyff starts the game almost in a kind of inside right position in midfield. And he comes over to the left in that sort of that inside left position, as we're more used to seeing him in, certainly in this sort of period later in the game. And he actually, I think, performs quite a useful defensive service as well. Because if you think the way that Panathinaikos worked, Haris Gramos, who the number seven, who played on that right-hand side, he was key in creating stuff for Antoniadis throughout this European Cup run. Now, all of a sudden, when Cruyff comes over and Kaiser's there already, all of a sudden, Tomáras has got a problem. So Gramos has to come back and help him out. And when he's doing that, he can't create anything for Antoniadis. So Antoniadis, he does have a few decent, presentable glimpses at goal. And we talked about that one in the first half where Vasovic misjudges the clearance. And it's a really good chance for Antoniadis that he's not expecting. And he doesn't quite get it on target.
Stoy does himself no favours also. And basically, just to explain to people, Vazovic, under not very much pressure, just hoofs the clearance in the air.
Stoy, just a massive slice, isn't it?
Yeah, Stoy, the keeper, kind of comes out, but he's never going to get there. And Antoniadis gets his header there first. And I don't know who the covering defender is, but he's gone too far. So if the ball was like on target, it would have just sort of crept in. But as it was, it bounced, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet wide.
Yeah, that's right. But that is the sort of chance that Antoniadis was getting. He wasn't really... Gramos wasn't really able to create for him as much as he would like to do. So Antoniadis was tough for Ajax to play. But fortunately for them, he wasn't having that many chances created for him.
Mm. And that link, sorry, that link up between Cruyff and Kaiser. Ajax hit the frame of the goal in the second half. It's a slightly freakish occurrence. It's a miss-hit cross from Kaiser.
Yeah.
But the space comes from this brilliant little 1-2 between Kaiser and Cruyff. And they've been doing that kind of thing all game. That link up was it's incredibly. By that point in the game, Panathinaikos had started to say, right, we've just got to let them. We've got to accept that's a risk because we do have to try and find the equaliser. Mm-hmm. But that was the risk. And then it's Cruyff who sets up the second with some brilliant sort of close control.
Popping up where he started the game.
On the right, yeah. Inside right position, slips the pass through for half-time substitute, Ari Hahn. And then deflected shot. So a little bit fortuitous, but...
But that was it, really, 2-0 in the game.
And that was, what, 3 minutes from time?
Yeah, just minutes.
It could have been, could easily been another 1-0.
Yeah.
I mean, that would have been seen as another 1-0.
That's what you mean, yeah. But 3-1-0 wins. Yeah. But it's funny, though, because you think of Ajax, you think of total football, you think a lot of goals scored and all the rest of it, but you're right. Out of the three finals, that hat-trick of wins, only one was 2-0.
Yeah, well, I mean, that I think is a really interesting point more generally, that it is seen as being an attacking form of football. And obviously, because it's set in counterpoint to Catenaccio and... Mm-hmm. And your Celtics, I mean, I don't want to say Celtic played total football under Jock Stigler, they didn't, but their waves of attacking football were what sort of eventually crushed the great Inter. Mm-hmm. and psychologically damaged them so badly. They didn't just beat them in the final in 67, but Inter then went to a tailspin and threw away Serie A as well. And then Herrera, I think, never quite recovered from that. So there was definitely a general narrative at the time of Catenaccio on the one hand, attacking football on the other, of which total football was... the most advanced and exciting form. And yet, the real innovation of total football is the use of offside as an offensive tool.
Mm.
Mm.
Of pressing up a pitch, of that press being facilitated by your back four, pushing high, you're using offside to prevent the opposition being able to counter you. I mean, I interviewed Mourinho Pérez, who was Brazil's captain of the 74 World Cup, and they had a great game against the Netherlands. Netherlands won 2-0 in the second group stage. A very violent game, magnificently violent game. I mean, Pérez knocked out Johan Neeskens, which is some effort.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they end up playing for Barcelona together the following season.
Right.
Mourinho was saying... I interviewed him. He lives in São Paulo. I interviewed him there, and he's got this incredibly sort of floral deco in his house. Completely doesn't fit his hard man image. And these two little yappy, poodly terrier things.
But a Brazilian footballer who had his day in the 70s.
Yeah,
the floral vibe. Do you know what? It does fit for me.
Very Laura Ashley.
We've all got our guilty pleasure.
But he was saying that in Brazil, they called that high offside line the donkey line because he just thought it was stupid.
Mm.
You play a ball over the top, somebody runs on. How can that ever work? It just leaves you very open. And he gets to Barcelona. He's been signed in the summer of 74 for Barca. So he's got Cruyff on the side. Neeskens has turned up. Michels is the coach. And he's told, no, you have to press. And he sort of slowly gets his head around the idea of, if we press quickly enough and in unison, actually the player with the ball... hasn't got time to play the ball over the top. And he said he remembers his first training session when it clicked. And he presses up and he thinks, brilliant, I've finally got it. Only to find Michael screaming at him going, why have you stopped? Keep going, keep pressing. Your job's not just to hold the line, it's to go and get the ball as well.
Yeah.
And it's just so alien to what he'd been doing before. But that, of course, is why total football was such a revelatory thing.
But I find
it just sort of totally subverted people's expectations of what defenders should do and how you stop the opposition from scoring.
It's the bamboozling nature of it that I find so incredible. You were saying earlier, Jonathan, that you're trying to figure out what formation they're playing and you're trying to look at the game with, from a certain vantage point from cameras and all that, and yet what will the opposition think? And then when you start talking about Cruyff, Andy, saying, he popped up in this position where it's where he started and he'd gone all over the place. It's an absolute sort of phenomenal and fascinating thing. But also as well, like their dominance is to keep the ball. That idea of, well, if we have the ball, they can't score, which is, of course, the complete opposite to years later what Jose Mourinho would come up with, who's, of course, the great anti sort of total football type of manager. But it is that the sheer dominance of other teams would be to blow teams away, score 5, 6, 7, like Guardiola's Manchester City, to use another, you know, modern reference. Whereas theirs is to dominate, completely bamboozle the opposition. And if you've got the one goal lead, they can't get the ball of us and they don't know what we're doing and we're running rings around them.
I was just going to say that the one thing that I do think is worth pointing out is that whereas Panathinaikos squeaked their way to the final, Ajax didn't. They got past teams with a lot more. You have to respect the fact that this is a final and this is the first final that they won. Because, like I said, I think they started this game super confidently, like they wanted to smash them, and that they weren't able to, that it was tense. I think you have to give credit, A, to Panathinaikos, and B, you have to respect the fact that it's a final. And Ajax hadn't made it yet. You know, they didn't quite have the swagger of winners. There are little bits where they have that swagger, and, you know, you can tell by the way the crowd responds to them. And it's funny when you hear Wolstenholme on the commentary, when you read match reports about it, the atmosphere at Wembley. I mean, Kenneth Wolstenholme said Wembley has never seen or heard anything like it, because
5 years after England won the World Cup and this is a better atmosphere.
It's incredible, because, you know, you talk about the fact that there are loads of Greek and Greek Cypriots who've immigrated to London in the 50s and the 60s. They're
Ajax always took a lot of support, though.
Loads of Dutch, and yeah, the minute the final whistle comes, like loads of Ajax fans pile on the pitch, and Wolstenholme's going, "Oh, the police have lost control of it." he's going crazy. Like people are. There's a sense that they are really gripped by the moment. They are really gripped by the fact that, yeah, this is the start of something. This is the start of a movement. There is the fact that Van Dijk and Kaiser and Cruyff, they look like rock stars.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is all part of it. But underneath it all, Ajax still a little bit nervous until they get over the line.
The point you make about pace, I think, is key there. That, yeah, I think, speaking very, very roughly, but the divide when you look back at old football between when it looks like something very slow and very alien or it looks like something like the modern game, and it's that late 60s period when pressing comes in, that's the difference. So I think there's even moments of England in 66 when it looks like modern football, but you're right, this is overtly modern football. And that ties into a point you were making about that position v possession dynamic. I think this Ajax, had they been in the modern age, I think they would have won games more easily. But remember, they're doing this on 60s and 70s nutrition.
Yep.
Admittedly, as it subsequently turned out, taking amphetamines. Maybe not this side, but certainly subsequent Ajax sides. Sala Muller, their physio, has been very open that they took amphetamines.
Yeah.
But they couldn't press for 90 minutes. They could press for 50 or 60 minutes. So what do you do in the other 30 to 40? Well, you hold the ball.
Let the ball do the work.
And you have a rest. Mm. And you're having a rest on your terms. Whereas now, nutrition, fitness is so good that Guardiola Manchester City can keep going for 90 minutes. And so they can just batter teams. And, you know, okay, some games will be winning 3 or 4 at half time. But a lot of games, a team's resolve just breaks in the last 20, 30 minutes. Mm. And then there's the deluge of goals. So I think that's one of the reasons for that differential, because, you know, a recent team who focus on possession, who win 1-0, would be the Spain national team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think this Ajax is much more akin to a Guardiola side than to the Spain national team of Aragonés or of Del Bosque.
Interesting. Well, we'll leave it there, Jonathan. Good point to end on. Andy, it's been a pleasure having you here. Thank you very much. The 1971 European Cup final will live long in the memory. Thank you very much for listening to The Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Do check out The Blizzard, of course, theblizzard.co.uk for more of this kind of content. Obviously, Football Ramble Daily as well. Podcasts from Monday to Saturday. But until next week, Andy, a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Cheers, thank you.
See you next week.
This was a Stakhanov production.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift-giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.